This is People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we take a look at the big swing to the right that took place as a result of the recently completed elections here in the United States. With historian and political activist Chris Mahan.
Demoralization is wrong, but I think shock is absolutely appropriate, and we want them to be shocked. And anyone listening to this program, you should be shocked. People need to take that shock and that anger and that outrage and transform it into energy, transform it into activity, and especially transform it into agitation and begin to speak out against the system that has led to these outrages.
And we look at government efforts to break the dock workers union with Louisa Gratz, president of Local 26 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.
The Pacific Maritime Association and these employers have also been lobbying concurrently to put my union, the ILWU, and particularly the Longshore Division, under the National Railway Labor Act, which would essentially choke off all of democracy within the organization.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Louisa Gratz is president of Local 26 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU. She was a guest on the Southern California-based People's Tribune Television, hosted by Kathy Venn and Marshall Blasowski.
What the press is perpetuating and what the government is perpetuating are deceit, is basically deceit. The events that led up to the lockout is something that was actually in the process of being engineered 7, 8, 10 years ago and has been going on worldwide to attack unions and in our hemisphere, the stevedores in Mexico. The government took over the Longshore Union, trashed the records, confiscated the records, destroyed the union hall, jailed the officers. This has been going on in various countries. The docker strike in New Zealand, they destroyed the union in New Zealand. If you recall, there was a strike a few years ago in Australia, which was a successful strike, even though they crippled the unionization efforts there. The union still survived, reformed, and came back. In England, under the Thatcher regime, there was the Liverpool dockers, in which they privatized the docks and essentially destroyed the dispatch system. So there's really worldwide effort to destroy unions. Mm-hmm. This is our turn and to be attacked. So in an attempt to build a bargaining position, the stevedore companies, through the Pacific Maritime Association, hired a guy to run the show. His name is Joseph Miniacci, and a lot of people are blaming him personally, but he's a very clever man, and what he attempted to do was to build a coalition, lay some foundation politically to get ready for bargaining, and in doing so, they built what they called the West Coast Waterfront Coalition, mm-hmm. which is a coalition which is headed by corporations such as Walmart and Target and Payless Shoes. And I have a list of many of those corporations, which, if you wish, I'll make it available to you. Mm-hmm. But what they did with these people is they told them that the ILWU was going to be difficult to deal with, and that the ILWU is a union that strikes over every little petty thing, and they need to be controlled. We need to keep the lid on that organization so that we can have free flow of commerce into this country. And what they did is they built up such a scare tactic amongst legislators and amongst these corporations who are fundamentally anti-union anyway. It didn't really require a big effort to get them to support the Pacific Maritime Association. The Pacific Maritime Association and these employers have also been lobbying concurrently to put my union, the ILWU, and particularly the Longshore Division, under the National Railway Labor Act, which would essentially choke off all of democracy within the organization, would choke off the union's right to strike, to slow down under any circumstances, to have redress for grievances, to, I want to say slow down, I say this because there has been 5 or 6 deaths on the waterfront in 5 years. 2 of those members were members of my local. The speed in the yard is phenomenal. People are pushed to load and unload the vessels as fast as they can. Time is money. It's not safety. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about protecting our lives and protecting our futures by working carefully, they consider it mm-hmm. just a slowdown. When Rudy Acosta was run over, I don't want to speak too much about it. It was pretty gruesome. But I asked to go before the employers so I could address waterfront safety, so that all people's lives could be preserved for their children and future generations, keep all their fingers, go to work, mm-hmm. come home the same way. They didn't want to hear me. I was asked to leave. I was told I could come into the room and sit quietly, but not open my mouth. So I basically told them, you can hear me in this room or hear me out of the room, but you're going to hear me, because we don't come to work to die. We come to work to earn a fair wage and take it home and provide for our families and our children and our parents sometimes.
Most of the country, indeed if not the world, heard the daily reports about a relatively recent lockout that was taking place at seaports along the western coast of the United States. Luisa Gratz explains why the Pacific Maritime Association instituted the lockout against the dock workers.
In building this coalition of political sentiment, which was intended to be antagonistic toward our union, they could not force us into a strike. Our position at the bargaining table is that we want to work, we want to earn a good living, we want our jobs for the future, and we want safe jobs, and they couldn't force us into a strike. So the only way that Mineachi and the Pacific Maritime Association could begin to build public sentiment against the union is to lock us out. They locked out the longshoremen and all the associated employees with the longshore industry to create public sentiment, to create problems for commerce, so they could then say, blame the longshoremen. See, they're being locked out because they're causing all this trouble. But the essence is that Mineachi and his strategy caused the lockout, because there's no reason that the ILWU had to be put in a lockout situation. The workers wanted to work. They mm-hmm. lost 10 days' wages. They have bills to pay. So this was to threaten us with employer power, to let us know that they could squish us if they wanted to, and the public would be misled into thinking that it was a strike, but it was not a strike. People wanted to work and were prevented from working legally. That's what the lockout was. Mm-hmm. And because they couldn't force us into anything, they called on their friends in Washington. Dianne Feinstein was one of the initiators by saying, let Bush come in and implement an injunction. The lockout procedure is essentially an injunction by the government to force people back to work. But we were never not working on mm-hmm. our own. We were forced off the job. The gates were locked. And the effort really should have been is to force the employer to bargain, because the employer's not bargaining in good faith.
In the dispute between the ILWU and the Pacific Maritime Association, the Bush administration invoked what's known as Taft-Hartley.
The Taft-Hartley law is a part of the National Labor Relations Act that is used by the government when they believe, whether truthfully or not, and it's used politically to force workers and their employers to not engage in any strikes or lockouts. And what they do is they go into federal court and they try to get an injunction, and they make their case that whatever labor dispute is taking place, a strike or a lockout, is affecting the commerce mm-hmm. in the country.
The tactic of using lockouts against employees is not isolated to the docks. Long Beach Memorial Hospital has also used a lockout in order to beat back union efforts by some of its employees.
They're hiring scabs. They locked out the nurses. And they hired scabs, and from what I've been told, they're paying close to $500,000 a day to bring these scabs in and have these scabs work, and that kind of money would be a sufficient amount to pay the workforce's pension. This is unconscionable, where they can't give the nurses a pension. The CEO, Barry Arbuckle, for the fiscal year ending 2001, makes $350,000. The president, Thomas Collins, makes $674,000 a year. And this is the hospital that's taking money from the consumer to take care of their sick.
The central focus of the dispute between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association has been the issue of technology. Not so much the implementation of the technological advances themselves, but who will have those jobs. Through the use of advanced computerization, robotics, and information technology, it's conceivable that the work needed to be done to unload a ship in the United States could actually be done from halfway around the world, once again allowing management to dismantle living wage jobs and increase profit at the expense of workers. Luisa Gratz.
Do you remember the war in Grenada? After the war in Grenada, American Airlines reduced their ticket processing staff, and I can't remember the exact terminology, so you'll probably get phone calls if I'm wrong. But what they did is their ticket canceling and processing operation was then moved to Grenada, and they laid off that group of workers in the United States, and they could get their tickets processed for about $2 an hour down there, which is a lot cheaper than here. But the process of relocating American jobs is very interesting because Walmart imports, is the largest importer of goods. About 60-65% of goods coming into this country comes from China. What happens to all the American jobs that have been replaced? People that used to work in this country, used to have good union jobs, are laid off, benefits gone, pensions gone, and they're now living off of where? They have a job at McDonald's?
Right.
Is that going to pay for their kids to go to school? Is that going to pay for their medical? Well, all of these that's being imported, all the complaints that they have against our union, many of these jobs, building bicycles, building refrigerators, building stereo sets, building computers, building a lot of things that you're not, clothing,
right,
the stuff used to be made by American workers. Now we can export just as quickly as we can import, and we're not exporting anything anymore.
And you know, some of it is you know, it would be fine if everybody got paid pretty much the same thing. I mean, in other words,
but we don't.
If the workers in China were making, or in other countries, Mexico, were doing okay, there wouldn't be that incentive to do this.
They're moving from Mexico to El Salvador. They're moving from El Salvador to Guatemala. And they're going to leave China and go somewhere else because the Chinese people make a dollar a day, and they're going to find somebody who'll do it for 75 cents. And they'll find it. They'll find someone who'll do it for 50 cents. And the United States, to become a strong nation, again, needs to start being productive, paying good wages, and put Americans back to work.
Luisa Gratz is president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 26. She was interviewed by Marshall Blasovsky, host of the Long Beach-based cable television program, People's Tribune Television. My name's Mike Thornton, and you're listening to People's Tribune Radio. On Election Day in November in the United States, something unprecedented happened. In a midterm election, the Republican Party, which already had control of the presidency and the House of Representatives, took control of the United States Senate as well. Against almost all predictions and with few exceptions, the Republicans swept into power in state and local races as well. We talked with writer, activist, and people's historian Chris Mahan about these events.
We have had a Republican landslide. We have a situation where both houses of Congress will be controlled by the Republican Party, and that's that's of critical importance in terms of moving legislation. There was a sharp move to the right in the country.
Mann points out that even in the state of Illinois, where a Democrat won the governorship, that when you look at the type of person who was actually elected, there really isn't much of a difference.
When you have a governor who's elected in Illinois, who's the son-in-law of one of the main ward bosses of the Chicago machine, the Chicago Democratic machine, that isn't that much different from in other states a Republican being elected. One of the things that's very disturbing about national politics is you see this situation where there's this sort of herd mentality that's being developed, where distinctions between the parties are being eliminated, and there's this, what's ostensibly a center, you know, the moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats, who are almost indistinguishable from one another, and in fact aren't really moderate. I mean, when you're talking about cutting children off of welfare, endangering the lives of a million children, as Bill Clinton did with the welfare so-called reform, that isn't moderate at all.
Chris Mann regularly guests on this and other radio programs to talk about history and putting current events into historical perspective. We asked him to do that with the November elections.
In some of the other situations that we've talked about, situations where a unity breaks apart, you have to look at the roots of that, and often the roots are in the economy. I mean, almost always the roots are in profound economic changes. I mean, if you look at the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in the period between, say, the post-Civil War era or the beginning of the 20th century up through even the 1970s, that you had, maybe a little bit before that, you had a situation where particularly the Democratic Party had a certain base. I mean, its base was the cities, its base was factory workers and in some cases small shopkeepers and a certain section, maybe a section of the farmers, but it's the foundation for, so I mean, certainly in a city like Chicago, the foundation for the Chicago Democratic machine was, I was telling someone new to Chicago the other day that what the machine is a machine to create something, and what it creates is voter turnout. The reason that something like that can exist is because you have a certain economic situation. I mean, you have factories, you have an industrial era, you have factories all over the city, you have people work in those factories, you have people coming into the city to work in those factories, and some of them are immigrants from rural areas or from another city or often from other countries, and they come into the city and they need help, they need social services, they need advice, and the precinct captain would meet them in some cases at the when the train arrived at the train station and introduce himself and help someone get a job, and then on election day you were supposed to pay that person back by voting for the machine-endorsed candidates. So that was the foundation for the Democratic Party. But the problem is, I mean, in Chicago, it's really, you see that in really stark, really extreme terms. And, I mean, people would literally be met at the train station and taken in hand, and the precinct captain would come to the wake of someone's grandmother when they died, and all these things, these political favors were then paid back with a vote on election day. Now, in some parts of the country, it was less extreme than that. I mean, maybe a smaller city and so forth, but still, that was the foundation for the Democratic Party, and the foundation for that situation was that people had industrial jobs. But what we've seen now is when you have a situation where there's a fundamental change in the economy, that everything goes into crisis. And so you just don't have the same social base for the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I mean, now in addition to this kind of situation, you also had a situation where because people were employed and they basically then supported the system and the system could function. I mean, people went to work, they drew their paycheck on Friday, They spent their money during the weekend and paid their bills, and then they ran out of money usually and went back to work. And you might have been in a situation where you didn't get ahead very much, but still you could survive. Now we have a situation with the development of particularly of electronics, where all that has changed, where there's massive unemployment, where people don't feel the same loyalty to the precinct captain that they, or any part of the Democratic Party apparatus that they did before, and where the entire society really has gone into crisis because of this development of unemployment. I mean, a qualitatively new kind of unemployment where people are permanently unemployed. They're not just out of work for a few months.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the currency that the Democratic Party used to barter with, which was jobs and or services, things like that, that more and more those things just simply don't exist. And so on one hand, people are talking about a crisis in leadership in the Democratic Party, which, I mean, I think there is that too. But there's also sort of the issue of, as you laid it out, as happening in Chicago, the Democratic Party doesn't have the same type of perks and or bribes, if you want to call them, to give out anymore.
That's exactly right. They just don't. I mean, they don't have that same kind of influence. And you also have a situation where they can't take the same positions in a certain sense that they did before, that when you had a situation where people were employed, most people were employed, and the economy essentially functioned. I mean, again, it functioned badly. It functioned in an exploitative way where some people made a whole lot more money than other people, but the society worked. I mean, they used to call Chicago the city that works, you know, in the sense that the essential social services actually get done, the buses move, things that are supposed to get done by city government get done. Well, now you have a situation where there's massive unemployment, where hospitals have closed, where factories have closed. As a result of all that, you have a situation where people, a political party or political forces in the society have to take one position or another. They either have to support the status quo and its moves really towards a police state to contain the situation, or you have to clearly be in opposition to the status quo and talk about the reordering of the society. Now, the Democratic Party did neither. I mean, at a certain point in history, the Democratic Party could be in the middle between those two positions. I mean, neither supporting at one point an overt police state, at least not in the northern United States, and not being for a complete transformation of the society and the overturning of the rule of the millionaires and billionaires. It was for some reforms, the civil rights movement, the reforms of the New Deal era. I mean, if you look at particularly the New Deal, that was an example of reforming the capitalist system, which at a certain point could be done because you still had a certain kind of economy. And so most people supported the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party was talking about eliminating the worst features of capitalism during the 1930s. But today there really isn't any way to eliminate the worst features of capitalism without eliminating capitalism itself. So you've either got to support capitalism with its worst features or oppose capitalism.
With this real turn to the right that's just happened in these elections, I mean, are we on this path of fascism, and is that path inevitable? I know lots of people who are really depressed over what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are really almost on the verge of giving up. I mean, because they really believe that it's almost an inevitable march to fascism. Is it an inevitable march?
It is not inevitable. I think that it's really important to understand that. I can certainly understand people's shock, their horror, and their outrage. I would say this, that if if conscious people, if people of goodwill, if caring people don't do anything, we're going to have fascism in this country. I mean, the motion of the state is towards fascism. But I think that if the history of this country and of the world proves anything, it proves that caring, conscious, conscientious people, if they intervene in the situation, that and if they struggle for the hearts and minds of the majority of people in a society, they can have a tremendous impact. I think that we should remember that the election took place on November 5th. 2 days later, there was an important anniversary in this country that went unobserved by most people or uncommemorated by most people, but it was still an important anniversary. November 7th each year is the anniversary of the day in 1837 when Elijah Lovejoy, an abolitionist minister in Alton, Illinois, was killed when he was trying to unpack a printing press and defend. He was defending his abolitionist anti-slavery printing press, and a mob surrounded the place where they were doing that and killed him and then threw his printing press into the Mississippi River. Now, in 1837, on the day that Elijah Lovejoy was killed, you had a situation where the slave owners controlled the presidency, they controlled the Senate, they controlled the House of Representatives, and they were starting to kill people who simply published newspapers disagreeing with them. And the situation looked very, very bleak at that time. I mean, there was a point right before the Civil War when Wendell Phillips, one of the greatest of the abolitionist public speakers, made the statement. He said, "No man alive today will live to see the end of slavery." This was just a short period of time before the Civil War began. So we've been in situations before when things have looked very, very bad. I mean, people at that time thought that slavery was just going to continue for decades and decades, and maybe in the 20th century sometime there would be some kind of gradual abolition or something like that. But what happened there was two things. I mean, one is that these objective economic processes that were going on, the development of industry, the development of the population in the North, forced people in the North to stand up to the slave owners. I mean, certainly the killing of Lovejoy shocked people. And I think today, right now today, I think demoralization is wrong, but I think shock is absolutely appropriate. I mean, if the people that you're speaking with are shocked, that's good. I mean, and we want them to be shocked. And anyone listening to this program, you should be shocked. But what happened in 1837 and what I think should happen now is that people need to take that shock and that anger and that outrage and transform it into energy and transform it into activity and especially transform it into agitation of their neighbors and their friends and begin to speak out against the system that has led to these outrages. Now, that's what happened in the case of Elijah Lovejoy, is that people started to say, well, any system that does this, commits a crime like this, we have got to get rid of this system. In some cases, they said, we have to get rid of it all immediately. In other cases, they said, we have to stop its expansion. But they started to take a stand against it. And it was actually at a meeting to commemorate Elijah Lovejoy and to denounce his murder that John Brown stood up at the back of the room and said, "From this moment forward, I dedicate my life to the struggle against slavery." And he went on, of course, to fulfill that promise.
Writer, activist, and People's historian Chris Mahan. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with social and economic justice for all. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the internet, www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.